We have with us live in the studios once again, Jav Parrish and Maria Tomczyk, both with Eat This Steak. Good morning.
Good morning.
Morning. I noticed how you didn't mention anything about me being live last week.
Well, there's still some debate as to whether you were really here or we're just reanimating you through the magic of science.
Yeah, there you go.
So, anyway, it is good to have you back, and I'm sorry the cough couldn't make it.
Yeah. Well, you know, they did try checking me into hospice, but they wouldn't take me, so.
Yeah. Too sick. We're working on that. Let's, plenty to cover this week, starting with local and a big decision out of the Supreme Court.
Yeah, the big news this week is the state Supreme Court threw out I-1053. That's the citizen-passed initiative that would require the legislature to vote in a two-thirds majority to raise taxes whenever they want to raise revenue. The state Supreme Court ruled it unconstitutional to put a measure that would change the nature of our government to a ballot initiative for the voters to decide with a simple majority. Instead, the court said that Republicans will have to do it via a constitutional amendment in which the legislature would have to have a two-thirds vote in both the House and Senate, and then it would have to go to the voters for a majority of voters to approve as well. If you're going to make that kind of change to the way the government functions, it has to be a constitutional amendment. And what I found kind of interesting is that the Supreme Court itself voted 6-3, which is a two-thirds majority on this ruling. So it really has turned out to be kind of an expensive civics lesson for taxpayers, for the state, and for Tim Iman. The question is, will he learn from it?
Well, no. They've already, both Iman and the number of people in the state legislature have announced they are, in fact, going to try to make that a constitutional amendment.
Which isn't going to happen, I don't think.
Well, it could, depending on the courage of certain Democrats. But the real issue here is, why did it take 20 years for this to be found unconstitutional?
Yeah.
1993 was the first year that one of these measures passed. Tim Iman, because the legislature can amend initiatives after every 2 years, for a number of years now, he's been filing this initiative or something very similar to it every 2 years. A lower court found this unconstitutional last summer, and yet, or last June, I think, actually last spring, and yet another Iman initiative, 1185, was allowed to proceed to the ballot with identical wording. And in fact, it was the prior initiative that was found unconstitutional. 1185 is still in effect, I believe.
Mm-hmm.
So the question is, why did it take 20 years to get a court ruling on something that is pretty plainly, just on the sheer reading of it, unconstitutional? And why does the legislature keep deferring to this, even though it's pretty plainly unconstitutional?
I mean, there's a couple of reasons for that. One is that it first passed during pretty flush economic times, so the state was taking in quite a bit of revenue already on the sales tax and property taxes and so forth, and it really took an economic downturn and a couple of years of economic downturn for the state to really realize, oh, when you combine this requirement of a two-thirds majority to raise taxes above a certain level, and you combine that along with decreased revenue and major cuts having to be made to the state budget year after year, then, you know, the political will finally comes about to challenge it.
But that happened with the dot-com bubble bursting and over a decade ago.
Yeah, but that was not nearly as bad as the 2008 housing market crash.
But,
and the 2008 crash combined a couple of things. It wasn't just a stock market dip. You could argue it was a major depression, not just in the stock market, but also in the economy as a whole. Plus, it was a fall in housing values, which impacted not just the state sales tax, but also property taxes.
Yeah. At the same time, though, you have to wonder, because, you know, the fact that we've had this requirement in place for so many years has really underscored the structural problems of the Washington state's revenue model.
Yeah.
It has hamstrung our state government for so long that at this point, there's there's nothing left to cut, literally, that doesn't involve people dying. And when you combine this with cuts at the federal level and at local levels, and, you know, we're seeing, for example, with the sequestration, which we'll talk about quite a bit in a minute, well, you know, state and local governments can just make up the gap. Well, no, they can't, because you're starving government revenue at every level right now, mm-hmm. and we're really seeing the cumulative impact of that over time.
Yeah.
All right. Moving on, McGinn versus Holmes. It's a big pay-per-view coming up.
Yeah, get your tickets. Coming to Key Arena, Mayor Mike McGinn.
Do they get to wear funny costumes?
City Attorney Pete Holmes. Yeah. No, there's been a kind of long running conflict over the negotiations for a police reform plan in the city. Now, last July, the city and the Department of Justice reached a settlement agreement over the Department of Justice investigation of the Seattle Police Department's use of force and accusations of biased policing. This has been going on for a couple years now. They were supposed to reach an agreement under the settlement agreement. They were supposed to reach another agreement on a reform plan. And a timeline for implementing reforms in the Seattle Police Department by March 1st. But the deadline, of course, needed to be extended because the negotiations have come to a standstill. Now, City Attorney Pete Holmes then went ahead and he did what you would expect a city attorney to do, a housekeeping measure. He filed the paperwork with the judge, James Robart, who's overseeing the agreement, to ask for an extension of the deadline. Now, that had to be done by someone, and it really is the city attorney's job to do that. But the question is, why do they need more time? Why have the negotiations come to a standstill? Well, Police Chief Diaz, it turns out, has been acting like the earlier settlement really never happened. He's still saying that the police department doesn't agree with the Department of Justice original report from the investigation.
Why is that relevant? Other than that it tells you that SPD is pretty contemptuous of the citizens of Seattle.
So what he's been doing essentially is he's been nitpicking the language used by the court-appointed monitor, Merrick Bob. He's been foot dragging and denying that certain changes need to be made. He's been saying, I don't like the proposed reform plan that the monitor has put out because these things within the plan, I don't understand the language. This doesn't agree with our understanding of the report, et cetera, et cetera. And that's been bringing the negotiations to a complete standstill.
Can I do a couple quick things on that?
Yeah.
Number one, that really underscores the importance of Diaz getting the permanent job as opposed to the other finalist who is a reform candidate. And number two, he couldn't do that foot dragging were he not allowed to get away with it by his immediate boss, who's the mayor.
Who's the mayor? Yeah. And you know, it really risks a court judgment against the city because this is all up in front of a judge, and the judge could rule that the city is not working in good faith towards a reform plan with the SPD for the SPD, and he could rule against the city and fine us and do all kinds of things. And so, of course, the city attorney is saying, well, you know, it really is a big part of my job to try to keep the city out of these kinds of lawsuits and to try to avoid this kind of litigation. So he said he literally sent a letter to the monitor, to the SPD monitor, saying, you know, look, if Chief Diaz can't come up with a good plan, if he doesn't like the plan that you've put out, here's what we would suggest as changes to the plan, and we're willing to negotiate on the city's behalf. And Mayor McGinn just kind of blew his top and said, you know, you can't do that. You're undercutting Chief Diaz. You know, you're supposed to be representing him. But I have to say, yes, it is the city attorney's job to represent officials of the city in negotiations like this. But how can he represent Chief Diaz when Diaz doesn't communicate with him and isn't going through him and isn't willing to work with the city attorney's office? The city attorney really has to do his job, and he is doing his job. I would say it's Chief Diaz who's not doing his.
And McGinn.
Yes.
And don't forget that when a certain mayoral election comes up next
this
year.
Yes, this is one of those things that could sink McGinn at the polls.
All right. Well, speaking of not doing their jobs, more info out this week about the 520 bridge pontoon problems.
Yes, it's really turning into a boondoggle. The cracks in the pontoons that we've been hearing about, I think it's King 5 that initially broke the story and has been following up on it. Those cracks have expanded over the winter, it turns out. The state will have to dip into the construction reserve fund for the 520 bridge construction project in order to pay for the repairs to the tune of tens of millions of dollars, and we don't yet know what the actual cost will be. We do know that the Construction Reserve Fund has $200 million in it, and that may not be enough. Now, we also found out this week that the real reason for the worst cracks is design flaws, and those design flaws were in there because the design was done by state engineers in order to save money on the project. Those state design engineers took a shortcut. They didn't test their design in order to save time, which means they didn't run it through the sort of normal testing that an engineer would do in order to detect whether or not cracks could happen. So any cost savings that were made by having state engineers do this quickie design on the pontoons will of course be completely erased by the cost of repairs. Worse still is the fact is that it's really early in the project to be spending down the reserve funds. This is stage one of a multi-stage project, and there's a lot of trickier elements of the project yet to be built.
I do have a suggestion for how we could make sure that there's more money available for the inevitable cost underruns.
Overruns?
Yes. Well, no, yeah. I think we just tell people that there's going to be a basketball team playing on the bridge, and you know, the money will then flow.
The money will flow freely.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. All right. Moving on, state legislature and Rodney Tom.
Yeah, well, as I mentioned, Rodney Tom doing a lovely pirouette to advocate for a permanent two-thirds state constitutional amendment. The so-called Democrat who's leading the Republican majority in the state Senate also out this week passed the immediate deadline for filing bills. Got a couple filed anyway through procedural tricks available to the Senate majority leader with less than 24 hours notice before a public hearing, and it's very instructive to see what kind of bills merited that kind of priority. We had SB 5452, which would eliminate all teacher job protections, meaning they could, teachers could be fired with cause at any time for any reason. We also had SB 5856, which would eliminate pensions for most state and school district employees, essentially privatizing them, replacing them with a 401k style savings plan subject to the whims of the State Department. Now, this is particularly significant because one of the main reasons that people are having such a hard time with the budget this year in Olympia is the McCleary decision, the state Supreme Court decision last year, that the state was not spending enough money on K-12 education and therefore not meeting its constitutional requirements to support education in the state of Washington, public education in the state of Washington. And here you have the Senate Majority Leader, the person responsible for the agenda of one of the two houses of the legislature, and ostensibly a Democrat at that, who still thinks the best approach to fixing our schools is to attack the teachers. It's really pretty appalling.
Yeah, and the fact that they're just not getting anything done in terms of the budget, and as Job said, in terms of funding the McCleary decision, just I find to be absolutely appalling.
Yeah, and he instead, within 24 hours, this is what got a hearing in the Senate Ways and Means Committee instead.
Mm-hmm. All right. Changes at the Seattle Times.
Yeah, the Seattle Times announcing this past week that in mid-March it will go through to a paywall for its online offerings at SeattleTimes.com. This is something that since the New York Times, which is not to be confused because it's not really in the same business, they print news, went to last year, a number of regional and local papers have started turning to this around the country. But the rationale was particularly amusing. Managing editor David Boardman saying that, quote, you will now have the chance to directly help support quality journalism in our region, as though this were something we were, like, you know, willing to do. The problem with that argument, of course, there's two problems with them. Number one, we already have the chance to financially support the Seattle Times. It's called subscribing to it in print, and their subscription and circulation has been plummeting over the last several years.
And you
years.
Can subscribe to their digital version, too, which I did for a little while until I found out that it's not the complete complete copy of the paper. And I asked myself, why am I paying for an incomplete copy of the paper when I could get it free online?
And beyond that, there's the whole issue with quality journalism, because quite frankly, the Seattle Times is not. Not only because they've decimated their newsroom over the past number of years, and have very little local content compared to what they did have 10, 20 years ago, but particularly since the demise of the print PI, the news content that they have had as opposed to their editorial content, or editorial board content, has really been infected with the biases of the publisher and the political biases of the publisher. It's much, much less, anything that could be called objective journalism in many cases, anymore. And, there's not nearly as much content anymore. And so you have to ask the question, why in the huge world of the internet, including any number of neighborhood blogs and other news sources that cater to this region, would you pay so much for a product that's not there? And this is the fundamental problem that print journalism in general and the Seattle Times in particular has had for the last decade. Their response to the changing technology and people migrating online to get their news has not been to improve their product to better compete. It's been to decimate their product and then insist that people pay more for it.
Yeah.
And it's no wonder they're losing readers.
And to pay more for a digital or online version that's not the complete version. I find that terrible. I mean, that's the reason why I gave up my digital subscription, and I'm sure that's the reason why people are going to hit the paywall online and they're going to go elsewhere.
All right. On to national and sequestration.
Yeah, sequestration, of course, unless you've been hiding under a rock, went into effect as of yesterday. Actually, last night, Obama signed the formal declaration that we'll start implementing the cuts. And just in case people are wondering why this very abstract concept is of such concern, a few numbers on what that will mean. In 2013 alone, the rest of this calendar year in Washington State, not talking about nationally, just about in Washington State, you're talking about losing nearly $12 million in funding for primary and secondary education, putting 160 teacher and teacher aid jobs at risk, 11,000 fewer students served, and 50 fewer schools receiving funding, another $11 million or so for about 140 teachers, aides, and staff who help children with disabilities. Head Start and early Head Start services eliminated for about 1,000 kids. Over $3 million in environmental funding around clean air and water water quality, plus preventing pollution from pesticides and hazardous waste. Another $1 million in grants for fish and wildlife protection. 29,000 civilian Department of Defense jobs being furloughed, taking about $200 million in payroll out of the state economy. 800 kids losing access to child care. That also, of course, impacting the parents who rely on it in order to be able to go to their jobs. $640,000 in funds to help upgrade the ability to respond to public health threats. $140,000 that are services to victims of domestic violence. That's 500 fewer victims being served. $1 million in funds that provide meals for seniors. Over 2,000 formerly homeless people, including vets, will be removed from their current housing and emergency shelter programs. That's a number equivalent to the King County one night count last month.
So you get the picture.
You get the idea.
It
just goes on and on and on with really every aspect of what federal and state governments do. And why is it being done? It's being done because we have a Know Nothing Party that is one of our two major parties in the national and state landscape who are refusing to even seriously negotiate, let alone compromise, on something that in the past Congress has done pretty routinely.
Yeah.
It's really appalling because all of these people are being made to suffer in order to make a gratuitous political point.
Yeah. The budget is a routine part of Congress's job, and it's like, as I've said before, it's like having one half, or in this case, a majority of congressmen come to work, sit down and say, I'm not working today. I'm just going to play video games. I'm not going to do my job. And it's not, and I'm going to do that day after day after day, and I'm going to do it month after month after month. That's literally what is going on.
Meanwhile, you're still going to pay me. You're still going to pay my health care benefits, et cetera.
Yeah. And what kills me is that, the idea of cutting waste in government is a really good idea. And that's the excuse that they're using to cover the fact that they're not doing their job. The sequester, however, doesn't do that. It doesn't cut waste in government. It cuts bone, and it cuts it randomly. It makes it all these across-the-board cuts to very vital and very important programs. And at the same time, it protects some of the most wasteful things in the federal government. A couple of things that should be the very first things cut, including money for the war in Afghanistan and the continuing war on people who are not quite terrorists yet. I mean, those things have been protected from the sequester, and those are the things that need to be the first things cut.
All right. Anything else on that?
No, let's move on.
Let's move on to decisions this week at the Supreme Court.
Yeah, I want to just briefly mention the two amicus briefs filed this week in the Proposition 8 case before the U.S. Supreme Court. That's the California ballot initiative that bans same-sex marriage in the state of California. First, about 75 to 80 prominent Republicans, many of whom, of course, are retired at this point, signed a friend of the court brief in support of same-sex marriage, saying that, one, it promotes family values by ensuring that kids have two parents in the household, regardless of the sex, and two, it limits government intrusion into people's personal lives, which is a very prominent conservative value.
Well, and some conservatives do.
Yes, I have to say it's about time that conservatives realized, oh, yes, they're supposed to be for limiting government, not for allowing the government to determine who gets to marry and who doesn't. And then on Thursday, the Obama administration kind of jumped in and said, oh, yes, well, we too want to file a friend of the court brief supporting same-sex marriage. It was almost came as an afterthought, I think.
Yeah. Also, the Supreme Court this week heard arguments on the constitutionality of the Voting Rights Act. That was the act passed in 1965. The section that's being challenged, Section 5, is the one that specifically requires a federal approval in 13 states and some specified counties in other states, almost all of them in the South, before they make any changes to voting laws, because of the history in those jurisdictions of specific racial discrimination at the ballot box. That is being challenged, and it's being challenged on the idea, well, we're past all that now. We don't have any racism anywhere in the country anymore, and we can just move on. When in fact you have particularly over the past several years in Republican dominated states, again some but not all in the South, a specific concerted effort to challenge to make voter registration requirements more difficult, to require voter IDs at the polls, suppression of the yeah. turnout to vote around things like availability of voting machines, all of these happening very specifically targeting heavily non-white precincts.
Yeah, and it comes after an election when the Republicans suffered some major setbacks because minority populations wouldn't vote for him, particularly a growing Latino population in the United States and the African American population, and women would not vote in great numbers for the Republican Party. And it's because of their policies. And because of those policies, you have a conservative Supreme Court now who is hearing a case to decide whether or not racism still exists in the United States. It's just, to me, extremely ironic.
And the questions that were asked, particularly by the conservative justices during these oral arguments this week, pretty strongly suggests that the court is prepared to overturn the Voting Rights Act, which is very, very discouraging. Now, you have to take that with a grain of salt, because remember, the same oral arguments led to widespread prediction that Obamacare would not be upheld.
True.
It was by a 5-4 vote. It's pretty hard to imagine anything better than a 5-4 vote to uphold the Voting Rights Act, which again tells you just how politically partisan the Supreme Court has become, and how detached from reality it's become, frankly.
Yeah, and on that same note, this week the Supreme Court rejected a challenge to the 2008 Foreign Intelligence Surveillance Act expansion bill, which was passed by Congress. Now, in 1978, the original FISA bill passed. It allowed the government to conduct surveillance on communications between U.S. citizens and people living abroad, but they had to get a warrant first. Now, the 2008 expansion by Congress eliminated that requirement that the government had to get a warrant and really expanded it so that the government can eavesdrop on anyone at any time.
And It also made it retroactively legal to cover the fact that during the Bush administration, the government had been doing that anyway.
Anyway, yeah. And so this lawsuit brought by Amnesty International, ACLU, journalists and lawyers of the prisoners at Guantanamo Bay was brought before the Supreme Court. The Supreme Court voted 5-4, the conservatives in the majority, of course, that the plaintiffs didn't have standing to sue because they couldn't prove that they had been harmed by the law. This came even though the journalists provided documentation that they've incurred significant financial costs in order to ensure the privacy of their foreign sources, a lot of them having to buy expensive airplane tickets to go and fly to foreign countries in order to speak in person with their foreign sources so that those folks would not be subject to U.S. government surveillance. They said this is a Fourth Amendment issue, and that the government needed to be prevented from unreasonable search of people's communications. Congress really now needs to change the law because clearly the Supreme Court doesn't think that the government is engaged in unreasonable search by reading everyone's email and listening into everyone's phone calls.
And the catch-22 that the Supreme Court upheld here was, well, sure, there's the secondary evidence that people have been affected, but really we can't say that you have standing until the government verifies that it in fact has been spying on you, which of course the government refuses to do.
Because it's all secret.
Because it's all, quote unquote, secret and a national security issue. And therefore, you can't prove that you have standing, so it can't be pursued in court, which is a nice little catch-22 for being able to do anything if you're the government.
Yeah.
All right. Also this week, the Violence Against Women Act.
Yeah, the House finally voted to renew the Violence Against Women Act, originally passed in 1994 and renewed each time since, except for last year when the House could not manage to pass anything. This year, they voted 286 to 138. All the Democrats and 87 Republicans joined them to pass the bill. It passed the Senate for the second time last month with 78 votes. That's all Democrats plus a majority of the Republicans voting for it. And the sticking points were that this bill included protections for gay, bi, and transgender victims of domestic violence, which I guess the House Republicans thought that people...
Well, they need to get beat up anyway.
Yeah. So, yeah. That gay bashing is okay. And another sticking point was that the bill would allow tribal courts to try non-natives in rape and assault cases committed on tribal lands against Native American women. I guess House Republicans also thought that beating up and raping Native American women is okay.
Well, there was actually testimony before Congress that this has become a problem on reservations because a number of serial rapists have discovered that if they go onto reservations to commit their crimes, they can't be prosecuted for it.
Yeah.
And so it's become a serious problem. And instead, you had 138 Republicans basically advocating to protect white guys' rights to rape Native American women.
Yeah.
There was a previous bill without that specific provision in it that didn't pass the House because all the Democrats were opposed, but it did get 166 Republican votes, which tells you where their priorities were, and they are not with protecting non-white women.
Yeah. Fortunately, the bill did, the stronger bill, the Democratic version, did eventually pass.
Right. Leaves us 1 minute for the State Department report.
Yeah, State Department back up the truck again. It's time for the Friday afternoon news dump. At 4 o'clock yesterday, released its updated report on the Keystone XL pipeline. This an update to the 2011 finding that the XL pipeline would be just fine in Ducky. TransCanada, the builders of the pipeline, has since been forced by local opposition to revise its route. And so the State Department preliminary to its finding later this year on whether the XL can be built or not found once again that there was no environmental reason not to build the XL pipeline, I guess, and the climate change effects were quote-unquote manageable. I don't know how you get to that conclusion, but they did.
I don't either.
There's now 45 days in which the public can comment on those findings. A lot of opponents of the XL wanted 120 days in order to do it, but we'll get 45 starting when the report's officially filed next week. And a reminder also that this update was done under Hillary Clinton's State Department. John Kerry, who is coming in, does have a stronger environmental record from his Senate days. So hopefully it will face some additional skepticism, but given the enormous amount of money and political pressure that's being put on the State Department to push this through, certainly yesterday's news not encouraging.
Events.
One event coming up this coming Thursday, March the 7th, 7 o'clock, Breaking the Siege of Gaza will be the latest installment of the Common Good Cafe. That's 7 p.m. this Thursday at United Temple, University Temple, United Methodist Church at 43rd and 15th Northeast in the U District.
Talking as we do every week with Job Parrish and Maria Tomchick, both with Eat the State. Where do people find Eat the State?
www.eatthestate.org.
And you can find some of my back articles at mariatomchick.com.